Dana.
I'm Hannah.
And today we are joined by Laurel. So great to have you on the podcast. Do you mind starting off by introducing yourself and talking a little bit about your path to becoming a lawyer?
Sure. My name is Laurel Francoeur. I'm an attorney in Massachusetts. I've been practicing since 1996. I have a son who has multiple food allergies, and that got me really into focusing my practice on food allergies and the law.
So kind of around like what time period did you decide to get into law? Like you started out in law, what was that time frame where you moved to food allergy based?
I started in 1996 and I worked in a bunch of small, well, first I clerked for the Massachusetts Superior Court for a year. And then I worked in a bunch of small firms. And then I got pregnant in 2000 and had my son and was trying to continue working. But when he was one, he was diagnosed with multiple food allergies. So at that time it was peanuts, tree nuts, eggs, soy, sesame, shellfish, and they thought wheat. So that was back in 2001. So there was little information online. He was the only kid in his class who had multiple food allergies at the time. So very little was available in terms of resources for me. So I kept working, part-time as much as I could until he had a reaction in kindergarten. He had a life-threatening reaction in kindergarten from building a gingerbread house that had egg in the frosting. And when he got the frosting on his hand, he licked his hand and went into anaphylaxis, and nobody at the school did anything. So luckily it was the end of the day and I picked him up and he was in the corner, cowered, like with hives all over him. So I had to give him an EpiPen, take him to the hospital. And then I realized I really can't practice right now. I need to spend my time with him. So I stopped practicing completely, and then just focused on learning all I could about food allergies and the law and how to help him. And it went from there.
Wow, that's a pretty scary situation. I'm glad he's okay.
Thanks.
Do you mind talking a little bit about the books that you've written?
So I wrote, initially I wrote a book about advocating for children with food allergies. And then I belonged to some support groups in Massachusetts and then was asked to chair one of the support groups. So I led a support group in Massachusetts, and through that I really started advocating, and I got involved with FAI, Food Allergy Initiative. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was a group that was started by Denise Bunning before FAIR came about. And I was an advocate for that group. And one of the issues that came up was flying with food allergies. And people didn't understand what, you know, the law was, what people's rights were, what we should be advocating for. So I did a deep dive into flying and the laws and so forth. And that's spurred me to write my second book, Flying with Food Allergies, because I realized there's really no information out there for people. So I wrote that book. And then the third book, I partnered with a friend of mine, Gina Minette Lee, who is an allergy advocate, but she also is a special education teacher. And we realized there was nothing for preschools. So she and I wrote a book, a handbook for preschools and food allergies. And that was accepted in New York. So all New York preschools were using that book when it first came out as a reference guide. So we're really proud of that book too.
That's awesome to hear. So getting into more so food allergies and the law, can you talk about what food allergies being considered a disability under the Americans with Disability Act entails for individuals with food allergies?
A lot of people don't like the idea that we use the word disabled, because a lot of people with obviously people with food allergies, you're not disabled. You know, you're fully functioning people and you get around in society just fine. But it's a legal term. So what I have to tell people is it's sort of a term of art that in order to qualify for certain benefits, you have to be considered disabled. And under both the ADA and Section 504, which is the federal complement to that, if you have some condition that substantially affects a major life activity, then that's considered to be a disability. So with food allergies, the fact that it affects your ability to eat, it affects your ability to breathe, it affects your circulatory system, your respiratory system, all of those fit under the categories for the ADA and 504. Now, what's interesting is it's not automatically. So the courts look at each case by case. So you can't automatically assume that because I have food allergies, a court is going to definitely find that I'm disabled and I meet this category. I mean, 9 times out of 10, they will. It used to be that food allergies were not considered a disability because the state of the law was that if you gave yourself an EpiPen when you're having a reaction, then you weren't disabled. You weren't, your system wasn't affected because you were back to, you know, basically quote unquote normal. So a lot of courts didn't think that food allergies were disabilities. The ADA changed in 2008 and added some more categories. It added other things. So for instance, you can't look at what's called mitigating measures. So this was also true of asthma. So before, asthma wasn't considered a disability because they figured you have your inhaler. So once you have your inhaler, you can breathe normally. So Congress realized that a lot of cases were narrowing the definition of disability. So they said, so one thing, you can't look at mitigating measures. So you can't say, well, just because somebody has an EpiPen, then that means they're not disabled. So once that law was changed in 2008, then we got more and more cases saying that food allergies are a disability.
So where does the ADA law apply and where does it not apply?
ADA applies to public accommodations, so places that are open to the public, and that includes a wide variety of things like bowling alleys, we'll hold off on restaurants, technically restaurants, but it's a little unique with restaurants, but things like preschool, amusement parks, things like that. It also applies to employers that have more than 5 employees. So if you work for a big company, then they have to follow the ADA as well. And it also applies to state and government entities. So certain state, so if you, let's say you work for the state, then usually the ADA will apply. It doesn't apply to, the only really exception is for religious places. So if you go to a religious school, for instance, the ADA will not apply because there's an exception for a religious exception.
So with restaurants, how is that different? Do you care to kind of elaborate on that situation?
So the Department of Justice is responsible for writing the regulations for the ADA. And they have guidance documents that say that if a restaurant does not normally alter its menu, then they don't have to alter their menu for someone with food allergies. So if you go into a restaurant and you say, I really need a peanut-free meal, and they don't have anything on their menu that's peanut-free, and they don't normally vary their menu, then they can say sorry, and they're not forced to accommodate you for that. If they are a company that typically does accommodate for other things, like say for gluten-free or other types of accommodations, then they may have to accommodate for food allergies. So it's technically they do have to abide by the ADA, but they don't have to necessarily make you a meal that you can eat.
Thank you for all the information. So moving to K-12, do you mind talking a little bit about the food allergy action plan that parents should implement with the school for their child?
So FAIR has an excellent action plan in terms of once your child is having a reaction, and it has, you know, you fill in the doctor's information, what signs and symptoms to look for. So that's very important because the school needs to know how your child reacts to a reaction, because some people, you know, might react very quickly. Some people might just get hives or something. So that document that you can get for free from FAIR is very important. But then the next step is, do you need accommodations for your child? So do you need, and accommodations are basically a change in the way things are done. So for instance, does your child need a peanut or allergen-free classroom? Do you need an allergen-friendly or allergen-free table at lunch? So that's another thing that you have to consider in addition to the medical part is, you know, how, and the standard is what would make it so that your child can equally participate in activities as the other children. So for instance, you know, if they're doing an art project, you know, should it be allergen free so that your child can, you know, can make the, you know, the egg crate thing that other kids, you know, it was something I remember my son, the egg crates, and I said, and I just, because there could be residue of egg in there. So most schools fall under 504, which is meaning any place that gets federal funding has to accommodate for food allergies. And most schools, almost all schools, fall under 504. Again, there are some exceptions, and the exceptions will usually fall under ADA if they don't fall under 504. So that is the accommodation process. So you can ask for what's called a 504 plan, and that is something that you sit down with all the stakeholders at school, and you sit down and you figure out what accommodations you're going to need so that you can equally participate throughout the school day. And then once everybody has decided on those, it becomes an official plan that is then legally enforceable.
So I know sometimes parents send their kids to school and they're unaware that they have a food allergy, and you know, they may find out while they're at school. So what are your thoughts on epinephrine being accessible in schools?
It absolutely has to be. If you go back to my son back in 2005 or six when he was in kindergarten, Massachusetts didn't allow epinephrine in the classroom. It could only be kept in the nurse's office. And for him, the nurse's office was on one end of the building and his classroom was on the other. So I said, this is ridiculous. So I actually wrote a bill and worked with my local representative, and it took us 7 years, but it finally passed. And now all Massachusetts students are allowed to have epinephrine in the classroom, in the cafeteria. So it's huge that they have access to it. Every state in the country has stock epinephrine for schools except Massachusetts. We're the only state that doesn't have that on the books. But in Massachusetts, what happens is a lot of these schools will get what's called a standing order and get extra epinephrine. So it's very important that there is epinephrine. Massachusetts has been, interestingly, we don't have the stock epi, but we have been keeping track of any time an allergic reaction happens at a school, the school has to report it to the Department of Public Health. And that includes people who weren't previously diagnosed. I mean, that includes parents who might come for, you know, to watch a play for their child and maybe have an allergic reaction. And Massachusetts found that 20% of epinephrine use was people who were previously undiagnosed. So that's a higher number than you would think. So there are a lot of people who are not aware that they have an allergy and are reacting. So access to epinephrine is crucial, because that's really what is going to save your life. And then you think about that during the school day, you know, so who should be trained? You know, states have laws on when you're able to self-administer and self-carry. You know, things like if your child is really young and you go out to recess, well, does the EpiPen go out to recess with them? If it doesn't, do you have an easy way of getting the nurse you know, the nurse's attention or somebody's attention to come out. So it's something that you really have to factor into. And the school bus, this is an issue I hear all the time. A lot of times school bus companies will say, we don't allow children to have their EpiPen on the bus. You know, 504 actually covers the bus ride too. So they have to accommodate for the bus ride, which a lot of people don't realize. And schools can't just say, sorry, our bus company won't allow it. You have to work out some way of doing that. So that's really something you have to think about. What I tell parents before 504 meetings is sort of to go through the typical day in your head and think about the allergy implications. So, okay, they take the bus. Okay, then what happens? They first walk into the classroom. Are they going to need to wash their hands? You know, and then they have snack. Where is snack going to be? You know, where is the EpiPen going to be? Then they go to lunch. You know, so I say think of a typical day in your mind and figure out all the things that your child would need throughout the day.
Can you talk about the differences between college accommodations and K through 12 accommodations?
It's a lot different in college. So you still, most colleges, again, get federal funding. So you're subject to 504, if not ADA. But what happens is in K through 12, you're guaranteed a free and appropriate public education. It's called FAPE. You're not guaranteed a college education. So the rules change when you get into college. So for instance, K through 12, the school has an affirmative obligation to find people who may need a 504 plan. In college, that goes away. It's up to the college student to self-identify and say, I have an allergy, and work with the departments to get accommodations. Second, certain defenses colleges have that K through 12 don't, again, because college is not guaranteed. So if you ask for something in college and they come back and say, well, it's going to be way too expensive, or it's going to all fundamentally change the way we do things, then they may not have to make that accommodation for you. Third is that college requires an interactive process, and it really requires an interactive process with the college student. I have had some parents who have wanted power of attorneys. See, because once you're in college, once you hit 18, then your parents are no longer entitled to any of your information. So sometimes parents will say, well, I want to be a part of that. And the schools will say, no, you know, your child's an adult. We're dealing just with your child now. I've had some parents who have said that they want a power of attorney, but it's really best if the college student themselves can sit down and talk. It's complicated because sometimes there's different departments. So for instance, housing might be under one department and the disability services might be under another. And, you know, academics might be under a third and they don't always talk to each other. But you're still entitled to accommodations. It's just a little different process.
So I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about the Lesley decision?
That happened at Lesley University, which is in Massachusetts. It's right next to Harvard. And that was a student who had celiac disease, and she was paying full price for a meal plan that she couldn't use. And so she had asked to be excused from the meal plan, and they wouldn't let her. It was a mandatory meal plan. So she went to the Department of Justice and filed a complaint. And the Department of Justice reached a settlement with the college, and they basically said, well, first, you can't make her pay for a plan that she's not using. So you have to give her the option to opt out of the plan. Second, you have to have meals that are gluten-free, and they have to be prepared separately in a special gluten-free area, you know, with all the precautions. One of the things they came up with was have the student go online and say to the university, okay, I'm going to be, you know, eating tomorrow. Make sure you have a gluten-free meal for me. So they could basically order it ahead of time so that the school would know ahead of time, okay, you're going to be eating in the cafeteria tomorrow, so we'll make sure that we have your gluten-free meal there. And if you read the decision, it's online. You can find it if you Google Department of Justice Leslie decision. It goes very, very through thorough the things that they're requiring the school to do in terms of, you know, like a separate, I think they said a separate like toaster. And, you know, they really had very specific, it was basically the best practices. And then that decision was affirmed for later on in Rider. It was, you know, Rider University also had a similar complaint. The problem is that I've had colleges say, well, that was just for that college and we're different, so we don't have to follow DOJ. So I've been getting that a lot in representing college students and basically saying, and I basically come back and say, well, look, this is what the government has determined is best practice. So, you know, if you're not going to do best practice, then you better have a good reason, because if I have to go to DOJ, this is what they're going to say you should do. So there has been some pushback I found with colleges. But I think as time goes on, they're getting the word and are doing more. So for instance, my son went to Clark University in Massachusetts, and they had an allergen-free station. It was free of the top eight. And they had their own microwave and toaster. The issue was, he said that they'd only have like two meals a day and they were lousy. Usually they weren't much flavor, or so luckily he had a kitchen in his dorm so he could cook. Another thing that he asked them to do, which I thought on his own, which I thought was very good, is he asked them to label all the products in the line, in the cafeteria line, so that he could know what to eat. And they agreed at that time to label even for sesame, which wasn't required then. But his school was a very small school and they only had one cafeteria. So, you know, he got to know the cafeteria workers. So that's another thing that I tell parents sometimes when you're looking at colleges, you might want to think about, you know, is smaller better? You know, as opposed to colleges that have, you know, 10 different eating places and they're all different. He liked the fact that he could get to know the staff there. They knew him. You know, he would say, hey, you know, you didn't label this pizza. Can you tell me what's in it? And they would tell him. But it all, you know, it depends. But that was just something that was important to him, was that there was one central cafeteria, so we didn't have to keep doing this, you know, with different cafeterias around the campus. So another thing that I did for him too was when I bought him, and another friend of mine does this also, when I bought him all of his pots and pans, so he had to have his own, obviously his own pots and pans, his own utensils, his own plates. I bought everything blue. So like his frying pan had a blue handle. So that way I said, you know, you can tell your classmates or your dorm mates, you know, if it's blue, it's mine, don't use it. So that way he could segregate his utensils from others. So I just, that just, if you're looking for a practical tip, that really helped, because then, because if you just, you might have your own set of pots and pans, but I mean, you know, in college, especially if you're sharing a kitchen and some people put their things down and some people clean and don't, whatever. So he would say, look, if it's blue, it's mine, so don't touch it.
That's a really good tip. So what actions would you suggest college students take if their college is unwilling to abide by ADA law?
One of the things you can do is file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights as part of the United States Department of Education. I don't think they do a lot. I haven't had much success in the few times that I've brought cases there, but that might be a first step. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't require a lawyer. You could file a complaint yourself, and they try to mediate the disputes. So they'll try to get the college to say what they want and the student to say what they want and see if they can come to some agreement in the middle. But the different times I've done that, it hasn't been helpful. The Department of Justice also can get involved. So you can file a complaint with them online. And again, you can Google. The thing with Department of Justice is they're so busy with other things is that they have to see that it's something that's important, you know, that it's something that keeps happening or something that could keep happening for them to get involved. So like, for instance, with the Leslie decision, they realized, you know, a lot of people have celiac, a lot of people are gluten-free. And so Department of Justice doesn't have to take your complaint, in other words, but I've had them take my complaints different times. Or you can hire a lawyer and, you know, and bring a case to court. But just realize that, you know, once you do something like that, you're bringing out the big guns. And, you know, so for instance, in K through 12, a lot of parents, you know, I'll say your first step might not be to just rush to a lawyer, you know, because you have to deal with this school for, you know, the next 12 years. And you want to make sure that you have a good rapport with them. So, you know, maybe going right to the lawyer might not be the first step. But trying to work it through with the college. And I think if you try to do it yourself, I think if you can bring things like the Leslie decision and say, look, this is what best practices are. You know, there's also the CDC guidelines. I'm not sure if, I think they might cover college. I know they cover preschool and K through 12, but they might cover college as well. And that might give some best practices. So I would say try to work it out first before getting a lawyer, and then hopefully they will work it through with you. And if not, then you might have to go the next step.
Well, thank you for all of that. I know a little bit earlier we were talking about airlines just a little bit, so I kind of get more in depth there. So do you mind talking a little bit about the Air Carrier Access Act and how food allergies play into it?
So allergies are considered a disability under the Air Carrier Access Act. The problem is, how do you enforce it? So when you fly on a plane, the ADA no longer applies and 504 doesn't apply. Interestingly, applies in the airport. So they have to make accommodations in the airport. But once you get on the plane, the ADA doesn't apply. It's this Air Carrier Access Act. And it basically says that airlines can't discriminate against people who are disabled. And they have their own set of regulations about what an airline must do to accommodate people with disabilities. The problem is, let's say you ask for an accommodation and you don't get it. The airline says no, you can't sue. So they do have what they call, I can't remember the name, but people on the ground. So every airline has to have somebody on the ground who is a complaint officer who you can file a complaint with and say, okay, you know, I was discriminated against on my flight. But those are the people that are hired by the airline. So, you know, they usually aren't going to be doing, you know, doing too much. But you can't file a lawsuit. You can file a complaint with the Department of Transportation. You know, if you just file a complaint, usually they just take it and say thank you and log it, and you don't hear anything. But technically, the Department of Transportation could fine an airline. And some airlines who have had egregious violations of, you know, people with disabilities have been fined. I'm currently, I filed a complaint with the Department of Transportation right now with some other people in regards to Southwest Airlines. But that's, we haven't gotten an answer on that. So that's one of the problems, is that there's no way to enforce it. Second, airlines are not allowed to make rules about peanuts on planes. So what happened was, probably, I think it might have been like in 2000, the Department of Transportation realized more and more people are getting peanut allergies. They focused on peanut allergy. and said, maybe we should have some guidelines, like maybe buffer zones or peanut bans. And some senators got together and said, no, if DOT makes rulings about peanuts on planes, we will take away your funding. So the Department of Transportation isn't allowed to make any regulations about peanuts. The one exception is if Department of Justice can show, I mean, Department of Transportation can show through studies that it really is a threat to have peanuts on planes, then they could reconsider. But, you know, we just don't have that kind of data. We have a few studies, but not enough. So they can't force an airline to have a buffer zone or a peanut-free zone, or even they can't even force an airline to make an announcement for peanuts. So that happened. And then in 2010, Department of Transportation said, gee, there really is still a lot of peanut allergies. It's really not getting addressed. And they said, let's put out some sample plans of what, you know, some sample regulations and have people comment on them. So people started commenting on them, and the senators came back and said, sorry, remember that thing we put in there, you can't do this. So immediately Department of Transportation took it down. So they can't make any regulations specifically about peanuts. So, but you do have the right to pre-board. And FAIR brought a lawsuit or complaint to Department of Transportation, where Department of Transportation said, yes, people with peanut allergy, and it's this question whether they made it as broad enough as food allergy, I think they did, should be able to pre-board so that you can pre-board and wipe down. So the issue with that now is we're getting backlash from the airlines. Because a pilot can deny you passage on a plane if he thinks you're a flight risk. So, and that's an ultimate decision the pilot gets to make, and they really can't be questioned on that. So what I'm finding is a lot of people will say, I have a peanut allergy, I need to fly to pre-board, can you let me pre-board? And then the airline gets wind of this, and then the pilot or somebody says, we don't think it's safe for you to fly because you could have a reaction in the air. And so they've been denied boarding. So that's something that needs to be addressed, because it shouldn't be a blanket. Everyone with food allergies is definitely denied, you know, should be denied boarding. So that's, I think, the next step in our advocacy is what we have to change. But another thing to remember is that they don't have EpiPens on board. So they have epinephrine in syringes. And the dose that they have is for somebody with a cardiac problem. They don't have the doses that we would have in an EpiPen. And the flight attendant cannot give a shot of epinephrine unless there's either a doctor on board or she talks to a doctor on the ground who walks her through it. So what you have to realize is that if you're having a reaction on a plane, that we were talking about access to epinephrine, it's very hard on a plane. So you really need to bring multiple injectors with you on the plane, because you can't guarantee that you're going to get that shot of epinephrine quickly from the flight attendant if you need it. You have to really be able to self-administer. So that's something that I tell people. Make sure you bring multiple EpiPens on the plane with you. And also to wipe everything down. So even if you don't get to pre-board, just when you finally sit, wipe everything down. You know, there was one study that showed that like 60% of airline trays had MRSA on them, which is, so they're pretty dirty. Although post-COVID, supposedly airlines are now fumigating the planes every so many flights. At least they were during COVID. I don't know if they're still doing this, but they would sort of fumigate it with this disinfectant that would go in the air and, you know, land on all parts of the plane to disinfect it. So I don't know if they're still doing it, but then, you know, then that deals with germs, but it may not deal with protein, you know, food allergy proteins. But so it's just always good to wipe everything down.
So we talked about wiping our surfaces down and obviously carrying multiple epinephrine auto injectors. Is there any other tips that you have that you would suggest for food allergy flyers?
Well, we used to say try to get the first flight of the day because it would be the cleanest, but I don't know if that's still relevant. You can ask for a buffer zone, but then you're running into this issue where the pilot might say, you're causing a problem. Don't use any of the blankets that they have there. So, you know, if you want a blanket or a pillow, bring your own, because they found that there's been residue on those. Don't eat the meal unless it comes packaged with a label on it. So I wouldn't eat any airline food that wasn't packaged or labeled, because you don't know what's in it. And, you know, they've even found, you know, roaches and needles in airline food. If they give you like a package of something that's like a granola bar or something, and you can read the ingredients, then that's okay. You might also want to have Benadryl too, just in case, if you get, you know, a lot of people just from the environment can get, you know, hives or stuff, you know, just, one thing you have to realize too, is so there's very little data about flying with food allergies. But the data we do have, the amounts of reactions on planes are very, very small. So I used to have a slide that showed a snapshot of the United States of how many planes were in the air at one time. So any given time, there's probably about 10,000 planes in the air in the United States. And the cases that we hear of people having reactions are very small. You maybe hear about 2 or 3 a year. So when you look at the statistics, you realize there's very, you know, it's very safe, in other words. I mean, for all the people who have food allergies, you know, we should be having more, you should be seeing more people having reactions on planes, but you don't. So, take some comfort in that, you know, it is very safe, and it's usually very rare that this happens. Another thing is, because allergies are listed as a disability under the Air Carrier Access Act, the Department of Transportation keeps track of all complaints that they get from people who file, who say, okay, I was discriminated against because I had a food allergy. And they keep logs of that. And those are all online on the Department of Transportation website. So you can look at carrier by carrier, and you can kind of get a sense of which carriers are better than others from that. So for instance, you know, they'll say like, you know, American Airlines had X amount of complaints this year. United had Y amount of complaints. And you can kind of look at that and see and say, gee, you know, maybe a carrier that has a lot of complaints about allergy, maybe they're not as good to fly on as some other carriers. It's not 100%, but it's something, you know, and you kind of, and if you look at the data historically, you kind of get a sense of which airlines are having more violations than others. But once you see that data, it doesn't mean that DOT did anything with that data. They're just sort of like telling you, okay, we had, you know, 10 allergy complaints this year on this carrier. But at least it gives you a sense, and you can see, gee, like if most had 10 and then there's one that had 50, let's say, and you might say, well, maybe I don't want to fly on that airline.
So transitioning into labeling laws in medicine, do you mind talking about the labeling laws in regard to allergens and medications?
So right now, they don't have to label for the inactive ingredients for allergens. So, I mean, they have to label for inactive ingredients, but they don't have to So like, for instance, if you have a food product, and let's say it's part of the ingredients are derived from milk, but it's some weird chemical name like caseinate, blah, 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 whatever. On the food products, they have to say contains milk, but they don't have to do that on prescription drugs. And so if you look at the inactive ingredients, there are so many long scientific names of things, and you have no idea, you know, whether that's a milk product or a corn product. Corn is huge. A lot of corn in those inactive ingredients. And they don't have to tell you. I had a case where somebody went to a pharmacy and wanted to know all the inactive ingredients, and they didn't tell her what the inactive ingredients were. And the court said it could be a reasonable accommodation for them to have to tell you to what's in the product. So there's a law right now, I think it's called the ADINA Act in Congress, which is going to make it mandatory for all inactive ingredients to be labeled the same way food products are, so that when you see those long names, if it's derived from an allergen, one of the top nine, it will have to say contains. But that was just recently filed, and I don't know how far it's gotten in the legislative process. But it's something that, you know, you have to really consider, you know, if you get a prescription. This also, some people use compounding pharmacies. So compounding pharmacies make the medicine from scratch. So I had a lot of parents with younger children. So for instance, if you got a cough syrup and it had flavoring in it, the flavoring might have corn in it, or it may have milk or something. So some parents would go to a compounding pharmacy and say, make me the same medicine, but keep out the flavoring, because the flavoring... but that's, you know, not all prescription plans cover that. It can be expensive, hard to find. But I know some people really feel confident about, you know, doing it that way. I will tell you right now, I have a client who's 91 years old who has an allergy to corn and had an allergic reaction to a product in 1970 that wasn't labeled for corn. And she has been advocating her whole life to get this addressed. And she filed lawsuits on her own, handwritten. She went all the way up to the Supreme Court. So she's made it her mission to warn people about corn, specifically in prescription drugs. And I'm thinking, gee, if it was hard for me in 2001, can you imagine what it was like in 1970? When, you know, a lot of allergists didn't even think corn could even be an allergen, you know, if you want to, I did an interview with her on my website, and she's an incredible woman, all the different things that she's done at 91. And then when you consider, you know, in the 70s, a woman, you know, didn't have a lot of clout back then, like, you know, she's supposed to just be working at home in the kitchen, and but instead she went on this quest. So just an aside, but she's an incredible woman. Her name is Jackie Frost, and it just shows you, you know, what advocacy can do. You know, I mean, she wrote a handwritten brief to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's just amazing. So,
wow, that's definitely very inspiring, and somebody that's really into advocacy. That, you know, food allergy education has come a long way, but I can only imagine how hard it was way before, I guess, I was born.
Yeah.
So my family, we go to a lot of amusement parks. That's just something that we really enjoy doing. So can you talk about food allergy accommodations in amusement parks, and more specifically about the accessibility card?
Yeah, so this is something new that that amusement parks are doing. I know Universal's doing it. I think Disney is now switching to it. So basically, there was this whole problem of people pretending to have disabilities so that they could get like a fast pass or not have to wait in line. So amusement parks were fearful that people were, you know, rigging the system or playing the system so that they could get advantages at the parks. So they decided that they would come up with a system where people could disclose ahead of time their allergy, and they could quote unquote verify or verify the disability, really. I mean, it applies to food allergies now, but the main idea was disability. And so, you know, things like wheelchair access or things like that. So they partnered with a third party company. And this third party company has people go online and submit a medical diagnosis, your doctor's information, permission for them to talk to your doctor. And then this third party decides whether or not you have a real disability. We don't know how they're doing that. We don't know who's making that determination. We don't know if there's any appeals process. If you don't like, you know, their decision, how do you appeal? And then they'll give you a card, and the card will say, okay, you technically now have a disability, and you can present this at the amusement park. It does have a QR code on it, so people can scan the QR code and see all the information about you. And then it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get an accommodation. So you could go into an amusement park and say, I have this card, I really need, you know, nut-free food or whatever. And they could say, sorry, we're not going to do that. Just because you have the card doesn't mean we have to accommodate. And I think that's very problematic. I don't think you should have to give sensitive medical information to some third party on the web that you have no idea where it's going, where it's stored, who's looking at it. It's also violative of the ADA, because the ADA specifically says that if you have you have to use a mobility device, or if you have a service animal, that you do not have to disclose the disability. So for instance, if you went into a park with a service animal, they can only ask you, you know, is this a service animal? And what is this animal trained to do? They can't ask you, why do you have that animal? So that's a violation of the ADA. But yet for this card, you have to say, and they even have the categories for people with service animals and wheelchairs, you have to disclose why you need the service animal. So right there, that's a violation of the ADA. So I have a problem with the card. It's fairly new. It'll be interesting to see if we have any lawsuits come out of this. But, you know, I think it's a lot to ask of someone to have to disclose their allergen to some allergies. Now, does the park have to make accommodations, let's say, in general? Yes, but what kind of accommodations? You know, do they have to offer you peanut-free food? No. Another one is, do they have to let you bring in your own food? Not necessarily. You know, I remember one time I went to a park in New Hampshire and for Halloween, and was waiting in line with my son, who's, you know, highly allergic to peanuts. And somebody asked the man standing in front of the haunted house, is this scary? And he said, well, it's only scary if you have peanut allergy, because we have peanut shells on the floor. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, they thought that would sound, you know, like, you know, the sound of stepping on the shells would be scary. And I said, you have peanut shells on the floor. I said, and my son was about to come into this haunted house, and you didn't have any signs saying, you know, there's peanuts. I said, he would have been in the middle of a dark haunted house, you know, with all this people stepping on the peanuts and having the dust come up, you know, and having a reaction. I mean, I was furious, and I went and demanded my money back, and I had to fight them to get my money back. But, you know, so that just shows you, like, things you don't even think about, you know, that, and if he hadn't made that offhand remark, we wouldn't have known. So it just shows you that allergens are lurking everywhere, and you have to sort of really, you know, be on your toes.
That's a crazy story. It's funny that you mentioned the peanut shells. I went to a football game a few weeks ago, And I noticed that they were selling peanuts at the concession stands, and I've never seen that before. And I noticed that the football fans were throwing their peanut shells on the floor. So instead of enjoying the game with my friends, I had to be worried about, you know, not stepping on them or not sitting on them. And it was definitely, definitely infuriating, I'm sure.
Oh, I can imagine. And the people don't understand the fear, you know, I mean, it's like you can't enjoy the game there because you're wondering, am I going to have a reaction? You know, it's just awful. A lot of ballparks will have, you know, peanut free days or whatever, but then they might do like one or two a year. And if you can't make it on those days, then you're stuck. And not everybody is sensitive to airborne. So there's also a big dispute about how, you know, how some doctors believe that you can be airborne to peanuts, some don't. But regardless, just the fear factor. I mean, if you sat my son next to a peanut, you know, even an unopened peanut, I mean, he'd be terrified. You know, he'd probably have a heart attack, even though it probably wouldn't cause him an allergic reaction. But again, that fear factor of, oh my gosh, here's something that could kill me in it. And I think people need to understand that, and that when people are asking for accommodations, it's not because we're, you know, asking for special treatment or, you know, it's because this is an emotional thing for people too. And people need to understand that.
So wrapping things up, Hannah and I wanted to know, what's the craziest food allergy case that you've worked on?
Well, I had one where a client was working for a nonprofit, not a food allergy nonprofit, but just a nonprofit. And told him that he had a peanut allergy, and they were bringing peanut butter, jars of peanut butter, into the office. And he would complain, and they wouldn't do anything. They just, next time, you know, make it even worse. He even got people on tape laughing about him and making fun of him and trying to get relief. I mean, we eventually settled that case, but it was sort of this attitude of like, it was funny, you know, that, oh, you know, and oh, he was just being overly sensitive. And, you know, it just, again, made me realize people don't get it. You know, I mean, that's not funny, you know? And I think now we're probably going to get more cases involving workplace, because a lot of the people who, you know, were diagnosed young are now transitioning into the workforce. So we're probably going to get more instances of that. But that was a weird one. I mean, the big one that I had was the Panera case, which was a child with peanut allergy. The parents asked for a peanut free meal, and she wanted a grilled cheese sandwich, and she got the grilled cheese sandwich, and hidden inside was a big blob of peanut butter that she couldn't see, because the worker saw peanut allergy and thought that meant add peanut butter. Yeah, so she had a reaction, and we got national attention for that case. We even made it on Snopes, if you're familiar with the website Snopes. So if you Google Panera peanut allergy grilled cheese. And then in talking about that case, people would say, why would you even want peanut butter on a grilled cheese? I mean, it's just disgusting. It doesn't go, you know. But that caused a lot of stir in the media and everything. And that happened in 2016. So yeah, if you Google Panera grilled cheese peanut butter, and you can see the frenzy that caused. But yeah, that was pretty crazy to think that peanut butter should go on a grilled cheese sandwich.
You were talking about the last case before that. I just kind of, I go back and watch like a lot of different shows from when I was younger, and I've started noticing more recently of like people having allergies, food allergies, like in the show, and it just being like a funny haha moment. And so I just think that kind of gives like a lot of false I guess, views on how food allergies are. And like, they're not funny. Like, it's not a comedy skit. It's in somebody's life. And I just don't think that other people realize that.
Yeah, like there's a Big Bang episode. I don't know if you ever watched Big Bang Theory, where one of the characters has a peanut allergy and he purposely gives himself a reaction so that he could buy time for a surprise party. So I don't know if you guys remember the Colbert Report. You know, Stephen Colbert, he used to have a show on Comedy Central called The Colbert Report, and you could go and sit in the audience. So I sat in the audience one day, and he has a question and answer session at the beginning. And I was there, I happened to be there for a fair event. So, you know, I had food allergies on my mind. So I said, oh, you know, what do you think about, you know, the fact that a lot of kids are getting food allergies, and isn't this something, you know, you should be concerned about? And he said, excuse my language, but he said, I believe food allergies are the pussification of the American child, that we're making kids pussies by, again, forgive my language, by, you know, making a big deal out of this. They should just toughen up, kind of. And he, you know, and here I am thinking this is a comedian. You know, he did end up later in another Colbert Report, not the one I saw, but he made a joke about food allergies. So, you know, and I think would they make that joke if it was somebody in a wheelchair? You know, would they think that that's funny? You know, somebody with some other chronic disease, you know. But for some reason, they think food allergies are funny. And it's just, there was a movie, I can't remember what the movie, it was a Disney movie that, I think it was a Disney movie, maybe it wasn't a Disney movie, that had a joke about peanut allergy, and there was a big uproar. Yeah, it's not funny. And it makes people think, oh, it's just some little thing, you know, you're just gonna, you know, you'll just get a few highs and, you know, your face will blow up. Oh, so I don't know if you guys are SpongeBob fans. So I've been a SpongeBob fan. Came out in 2000. I'm a huge SpongeBob fan. They just recently had a SpongeBob episode about allergies. And it was horrible. So you might want to look at that and see what you guys think. But so SpongeBob all of a sudden developed an allergy to Krabby Patties. So anybody who's a SpongeBob fan will know what I'm talking about. And they would have him eat the patty and his face would blow up. And they'd say, oh, you're allergic to it. But he didn't get treatment, you know, nothing happened, you know, and they were just kind of like, oh, you know, here you ha, funny, his face blew up. And then they had a final scene where it turned out it wasn't the patties that was making him react. It was somebody's cologne or something. And then they had every person in the restaurant have their face all blow up. And, you know, and that was like the ending, like it was supposed to be funny, like, oh, now everybody's face blew up. I'm thinking, you know, again, it's not funny. They didn't show anything about, you know, epinephrine or, you know, just like, oh, yeah, see, it's funny, you know. So I don't know if any SpongeBob fans out there want to Google. I think it's some I don't know, SpongeBob's allergy or something, but it just recently came out and I was horrified. But
I've definitely noticed that more and more now that I've, for the past few years, gotten into food allergy advocacy. I remember I was watching 30 Rock for the first time a few days ago, actually, and they were saying, as a joke, it was like, food allergies aren't real. It's just a state of mind. Like, it's just so prevalent in, like, media.
Yeah, and I don't know why. You know, again, I mean, you wouldn't joke about anything else, you know. Why they think it's something to be joking. Peter Rabbit, that was the movie that caused all the problems. When they had a reaction in that movie.
Yeah, I remember that. That was upsetting, but yeah, very commonplace, I guess, in media, unfortunately. Anyways, thank you, Laurel, for being on the podcast. It was great having you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really glad that you guys are doing this. This is such an important thing for people to, you know, get out the word, and you know, so it's great that you're doing this.
Thank you.